Get our Bibles over to Daniel. You guys may remember a couple of sessions ago, we talked about Daniel's vision in Daniel chapter 8. And we compared the vision in Daniel 7 to the vision in Daniel 8. The one in Daniel 7 gives the four animals, which I told you I believe parallels the Nebuchadnezzar's image. And it ends with this fourth beast that has 10 horns. And then there is a little horn that comes up among the 10 afterwards. And the I call them the mouth. Remember the picture of the horn with the mouth? And he's talked about as spouting off arrogant statements against God and so forth. And we see the same kinds of statements in Revelation 13 when it's talking about the Antichrist. He uses the same kind of language, referring to the things that he's going to be, you know, speaking boastful and pompous words against God and his throne and all of that. Then in chapter 8, we saw that Daniel has a second vision that seems to zero in on particularly two of these kingdoms, the Persian Empire, which was at the time in this particular vision was portrayed as a ram with two horns. And we know for sure that it was the Persian Empire because the angel gives the interpretation as being the empire of the Medes and the Persians. And then the goat that attacked the ram and killed it was Alexander the Great. It specifically says that it was the kingdom of Greece and that the horn between its eyes was the first king, which was Alexander. And then it says, it goes on to say that in the latter time of these kingdoms, and it talks about Alexander's kingdom being divided up into four separate kingdoms among his four generals. It says in verse 23, it says, and in the latter time of their kingdom, meaning the four divisions of Alexander's kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. That is, some other entity is giving him power. We see the same thing said about the Antichrist, that Satan gives him his power and his authority and his seat. He goes on to say, his power will be mighty, but not by his own. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. Through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, and he shall exalt himself in his heart and shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. This is an interesting statement because that's a statement that seems to be referring to Christ, but yet earlier in the very same vision, it says he will rise up against the prince of the host, and that was almost certainly a reference to the high priest, that Antiochus rose up. In fact, he deposed the high priest at the temple. Anyway, we talked about the fact that this vision says that the temple is going to be desolate for 2,300 days, and I gave you the theory that I have that the 2,300 days is the adding together of the time that Antiochus defiled the temple during the period of the Maccabees and the time that the Antichrist would defile the temple. If you remember, that works out to 2,300 days, give or take a day. Okay. My theory is that Antiochus is in fact the Antichrist, and he's coming back. We talked about some of the parallel language that's used in the Old and New Testaments in reference to him. Not only the little horn, he's called the little horn in Daniel 8. Antiochus is called the little horn, and the Antichrist is called the little horn. The abomination of desolation is another term that's used of both, and so forth. Now, what I would like to do is get into Daniel, this last section of Daniel in chapters 10 through 12, where there's an angel that appears to Daniel and gives him the future events in order as they're going to occur, but not in allegories, not in dreams, not in visions, not in, you know, represented by animals and you know, with fierce features and things of that nature, but specifically naming kings, naming their locations, what they're going to do, how this king is going to attack that king, and so forth, and we see this playing out, particularly in chapter 11. Now, let's look at, before we get to chapter 11, we need to look at chapter 10, because it lays down some groundwork for us about what's going on behind the scenes. You know, one of the things about the book of Revelation that is a little bit unique, well, it's very unique, actually. Daniel seems to be mostly concerned about the physical manifestations of these kingdoms, you know, as they develop and the things that they do, right? He talks, I mean, even when he's using allegories, he's talking about the physical manifestations of these kingdoms, right? Nebuchadnezzar and, you know, the Persians and Cyrus and all these things. We get into the book of Revelation, it seems as though another layer of Revelation is given to us by sort of peeling back the curtain and allowing us to see the demonic activity and the angelic activity that's going on behind the scenes that is what is driving these kings and these kingdoms in the physical realm. All right, and so we see, for example, Michael and his angels, you know, fighting against Satan and his angels. We see these strange beasts, which we have beasts in Daniel as well, but all of a sudden we have a new characteristic that seems to show up in Revelation that we haven't seen in any of the other beasts in Daniel. And that is this beast with seven heads. See, all the beasts mentioned in Revelation, and there are three separate accounts of this beast showing up in Revelation, and it has seven heads, and it has 10 horns on one of its heads. All right? All the beasts we've seen prior to this in the book of Daniel, they only have one head. And each beast only represents one kingdom. When we get to Revelation, something new is happening. What we're seeing is demonic activity behind the scenes. We're seeing these demonic entities that are driving these things. Now, the funny thing about Daniel chapter 10 is it also gives us just a little peek at the demonic activity that's going on behind the scenes. So let's look at chapter 10. We see the layer of the physical activity that's happening. We know the history that's going on. We see the time of the vision. It says in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. So this is 2 years after Cyrus gave his decree to restore and build Jerusalem. The Jews have now returned back. They've already rebuilt the altar. They've laid the foundation for the temple. The animal sacrifices are being offered. Of course, Daniel was too old to go back and participate in that. But in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar. The message was true, but the appointed time was long, and he understood the message and had understanding of the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. He was fasting. That's what mourning means there. I ate no pleasant food, no meat or wine came into my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all, till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. Now on the 24th day of the first month, from that you can calculate when he started his fast, right? On the 3rd. Anyway, as I was by the side of the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose waist was girded with the gold of Uphaz. His body was like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like torches of fire, his arms and feet like varnished bronze in color, and the sound of his words like the voice of a multitude. Does this sound familiar to any of us? You can't read the first chapter of Revelation without seeing the parallels, right? Only we're told that it was the Son of Man. It was Christ who was appearing to John in very much the same way, same characteristics and so forth. And I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, for the men who were with me did not see the vision, but a great terror fell upon them, so that they fled to hide themselves. Therefore I was left alone when I saw the great vision, and no strength remained in me, for my vigor was turned into frailty in me, and I retained no strength. Yet I heard the sound of his words, and while I heard the sound of the words, I was in a deep sleep on my face with my face to the ground. Suddenly a hand touched me, which made me tremble, on my knees and on the palms of my hands. And he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you, and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. While he was speaking the words to me, I stood trembling. Then he said to me, Do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand, to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come because of your words. You know, what's interesting about this here is it's clear now why Daniel was fasting and praying in the first place. He wanted clarity, and he wanted understanding of these things. And so God honored that, and he sent him special revelation. Verse 13. Now notice this. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. And behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. For I had been left alone there with the kings of Persia. Now I have come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days. For the vision refers to many days yet to come. Now, what's interesting here is, who is this prince of Persia that he's talking about? And is this a man? Or is this some kind of a spiritual demonic entity? Well, first of all, if this is indeed Christ, and not just an angel, and he is being opposed so that he's delayed in coming to Daniel by 21 days, this is some kind of a powerful person or being, right? It's a very powerful being. Well, let's continue reading. Oh, let me ask you this before we move on. Who was the king of Persia? Cyrus, right? Cyrus was the king of Persia. Was Cyrus opposed to what God was doing? No. He had read the prophet Isaiah. He had seen that God said, Cyrus, you're my anointed one. You're my shepherd. You're going to do my bidding. You're going to let my people go. You're going to rebuild Jerusalem for me and all that. So Cyrus was fully on board with what he had been shown of God's will for him and for what he was about to do. So he was certainly not in opposition against God. So why is this prince of Persia opposing this being, Christ or this angel, whichever it is? Why is this being opposing him? Does this imply that there is some kind of a spiritual warfare going on that is involved in these events playing out? With Cyrus allowing the Jews to go, you know, to rebuild the temple, all these things according to prophecy, and yet at the same time, while God is making the way for it to happen, there is supernatural and spiritual opposition going on through demonic forces in order to oppose what God is trying to do. Would you guys agree with that? That's what this passage is teaching. All right? Well, let's continue reading. It says, verse 16, And suddenly, one having the likeness of the sons of men touched my lips. Then I opened my mouth and spoke, saying to him who stood before me, My Lord, because of the visions, my sorrows have overwhelmed me, and I have retained no strength. For how can this servant of my Lord talk with you, my Lord? As for me, no strength remains in me now, nor is any breath left in me. I mean, this poor Daniel, the guy was, you know, he was in terror and fear at what he was seeing in front of him. Then again, the one having the likeness of a man touched me and strengthened me, and he said, O man, greatly beloved, fear not. Peace be to you. Be strong, yes, be strong. So when he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, Let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. Then he said, Do you know why I have come to you? And now I must return to the fight with the prince of Persia. And when I have gone forth, indeed, the prince of Greece will come. Now, we see here clearly that these princes, they're called princes of a specific kingdom or empire that are in opposition to God and his will. And we see that there is a sequence of at least two of them mentioned here specifically, right? There is a prince of Persia that was opposing God in what he was doing with the nation of Persia. And following this, he's saying that he has to go and fight with the prince of Greece. And we know, according to the prophecies here in Daniel, that it was the Grecian Empire that was shortly going to overthrow the Persian Empire, right? So what we see now is that Satan and his forces are every bit as much involved in trying to move nations and kings and all these things as God is in his plan as well. And that there is a war going on in the heavens, right? Over these kingdoms. Now, ultimately, we know how that war is going to turn out because we know who the king of the universe is. And he's got Satan on a leash, right? He's got Satan. He only allows Satan so much line before he yanks him in, right? However, he does allow Satan to move and do things in opposition to his plan, because ultimately, what is God's plan with all the nations? What is his plan? Is he going to bring all these kingdoms and all these wicked people? Is he going to restore them all? What is he really going to do at the end of the age? What's that, Rich?
I can see Israel, and what he's doing is the guy with the chip on his shoulder. Knock it off.
Yeah.
He's going to punish the nations.
Yes, he is going to punish the nations, and he's going to reward people, and he's going to punish people. But ultimately, God's plan is to divide the wheat from the tares, right? The wicked from the righteous. It's to expose the hearts of people, right, for what they really are, and then ultimately judge them righteously, and then remove the wicked from the earth and allow the righteous to inherit the earth. Right? I mean, read Psalm 37. That's what the whole psalm is about. He's telling you what God's ultimate plan is, right? He's going to divide them up. He's going to sift them out. The righteous, the wicked are going to be cut off, and they're not going to be anymore, and the righteous are going to inherit the earth and dwell in it forever. That's ultimately, I mean, if you want to put God's plan in a nutshell, that's where it's going. Does he allow wickedness and wicked rulers to rise up? Does he may keep them on a short leash, but does he do it, and does he have a purpose for that? Does he have a purpose for that? What would his purpose be for allowing these kinds of things and allowing people to choose sides? Who they're going to work with? Who they're going to oppose?
Well, he's
revealing hearts, isn't he? And why did he say he raised up Pharaoh? God said he's the one who raised up Pharaoh. Right? Pharaoh was opposing God, but God said he's the one who put him there. Why?
Give power to his great name.
To make his power known?
Yeah.
Right? See, God uses the wicked as well as the just to accomplish his purpose. Right? And so he does this with the nations as well. And he allows Satan a certain amount of leeway in order to try to bring about his plan. Now, obviously, I think Satan realizes that he's going to lose in the end. But he wants to take down as many people with him as he possibly can. Right? Yes? That's a good question, but he obviously has some serious power. Right? And in fact, as we continue reading, look down in verse 20 again. It says, "Then he said, 'Do you know why I've come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. And when I have gone forth, indeed the prince of Greece will come. But I will tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth. No one upholds me against these except Michael, your prince.'" Now, he's telling us that there is a powerful angelic being that is supporting him in this struggle against these wicked demons, and that is, in fact, Michael. Michael the archangel, right? Also, look at in verse chapter 11, verse 1. It's unfortunate there's a chapter division here because it's almost a continuation of the same sentence. He says, also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. Now, the same one that's appearing to Daniel is saying, look, I've been opposed by the prince of Persia, this demonic entity. I'm going to have to go back to this struggle. Then afterwards, the prince of Greece, I'm going to have to be struggling with him. And Michael is the one who is supporting me in this struggle. I don't think it's any coincidence that we see Michael involved in this struggle in the book of Revelation as well. Just keep your finger here and go over to chapter 12 of the book of Revelation. And we're given a little bit more of a peek into this. Chapter 12, it says, verse 1, now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and in her on her head a garland of 12 stars. And being with child, she cried out in labor and pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven, behold, a great fiery red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 diadems on his heads. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth, and the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. She bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. That's a reference to Psalm 2 and Christ as the Son of God. And her child was caught up to God and his throne, and the woman fled into the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God, and that they should feed her there 1,260 days. And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon. This is the seven-headed dragon that we just read about. And the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So forth. All right. So we see that there's a very significant event that is going to take place at the end of the age with regard to this spiritual warfare that's been going on behind the scenes now for generation after generation after generation, as all of these kingdoms. You know, you may remember that earlier when Daniel was given a vision of these kingdoms, he talked about how that he saw the four winds striving over the Mediterranean Sea, right, as though the north-south wind, the east and the west wind, and all these things were, you know, this turmoil and the waves and all this, and then he sees these beasts coming up out of the Mediterranean Sea, you know, as a representation of, you know, the different kingdoms that were rising. And so all of these things are coming up out of this turmoil of the four winds, you know, raging and so forth, and that, I believe, is a representation of the angelic and demonic warfare that's going on behind the scenes. Satan is trying to destroy God's plan, and God is pushing forward with his plan, and he's using Satan and his activities as well in his own way. All right, so what we see also here is that in chapter 11, verse 1, the same angel who says he was fighting with the prince of Persia and he's going to be fighting again with the prince of Greece, he says, I also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and to strengthen him. So we see that the activity of God and his angels on behalf of some of these kings was to actually support them and strengthen them, because they were carrying out the things that God wanted done, including Darius and Cyrus, right? Two of these kings. All right, now let's continue in chapter 11, and I want to go over some of these historical markers that are given here, and what we want to do as we go through these. Yeah, Chase, you have a question? You got to talk really loud because I can't hardly hear you up here. Louder, please. And Daniel? Yeah, assuming that angel is Jesus, of course. I mean, the description seems like him. I'm saying it's the same kind of thing. OK? okay? I'm not saying it's the exact same battle. I think there's a series of battles between the angels and between these demonic entities that are apparently local to specific kingdoms. Otherwise, it wouldn't be called the king, the prince of Persia or the prince of Greece or whatever it happens to be. There seems to be demonic forces that are attached to, assigned to, whatever, these various kingdoms. So as kingdoms rise and fall, it's probably different demonic entities that are involved. Right. So, does that make sense? Yeah. Well, I don't think it means Michael is the only one. I think it means Michael as the commander of his armies. All right. Michael is called one of the archangels, meaning he's some kind of a commander or a leader of other angels. So I think that when it says Michael, I think it means Michael and his group. Okay, not just one entity. All right. Tim, did you have your angle?
I was going to say, this angel doesn't need to be Christ because he seems... I wouldn't think that the captain of the host would be in a position of really needing a lot of reinforcements.
We really don't know a lot about it, to be honest with you. You know, I mean, there's a lot of demonic activity going on. I mean, Jesus was crucified, and there was a lot of demonic activity going on then, too, and God allowed it. Right? So, I mean, Satan entered into Judas, it says, who betrayed him. So there was a lot of this kind of demonic stuff going on, even while Jesus was in his earthly ministry that God allowed, which led up to his crucifixion. So, you know, it seems that Jesus was overpowered there by dark forces, but at the same time, it was ultimately for God's plan. So I'm not so sure that we can read much into that either way, to be honest with you. Yes? Yeah, but if that is Christ, and the only reason I even offer that as a possibility is because the description seems to be virtually identical with what John saw in Revelation chapter 1, and it's identified as Christ there, all right? So that's the only reason I say that it might be, but it's not necessarily so. Yeah, right, for a long time. So, you know, I mean, there's this, and look, this is not, if that is an appearance of Christ, all right, before the virgin birth, if it is, that's not his role. Isn't that right? Christ's role in the Old Testament was not to be a counterforce to the demonic activities that were going on. Right? He had a much higher, a much greater role than that. He was the one who confirmed the covenants, you know, to the patriarchs and so forth. So he had a different role. But in this particular instance, it seems that, if that was Christ, that for some reason God wanted him to make a personal appearance to Daniel. All right? And there was a lot of resistance. But again, I'm not saying definitely it was. It may not have been. Yeah, go ahead, Duke.
There's a lot of cases of spiritual warfare interacting directly with flesh of mankind, too. Mm-hmm. Like the angel of the Lord that took out the 185,000 Syrian forces, and then there's the Elisha and servant, and he said, those that are with us and those that are with them, we see angelic forces. So there's a lot more work, like we just don't see it.
Right. And the Bible is pretty clear that these angelic forces from time to time actually do manifest physically in the creation and can wreak some havoc. All right. But that's up to God and how he operates and so forth. But there we... Just keep in mind that when, you know, just like today, you know, you look out at the elections that are going on, you look out at how the world is being reshuffled right now, right? Our country is being reshuffled politically. Europe is being reshuffled politically. Players are being moved around. You think that's all just coincidence or how people vote or things like that? No, there's stuff going on behind the scenes that we don't know about, all right? Just keep that in mind. And ultimately, keep in mind that you don't have to worry too much about it because we know how it all turns out in the end, right? Because God has got it all under control. All right, well, let's go into these the actual revelation that this being gives to Daniel in very clear and specific language. So let's start in chapter 11, verse 2. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia. This is after Cyrus. And the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Now, does anybody know who this fourth Persian king was that was far richer than them all and that kind of stirred up the Greeks and got a hornet's nest going with the Greeks? Does anybody know who that was? You know your world history. No, it was after Darius. Xerxes. Yes, it was the king Xerxes. He was by far the richest of the Persian kings, and he thought he was going to expand his empire westward. And so he went over and decided to attack Macedonia and Greece and that area over there that wasn't bothering him, but he decided he was just going to go and invade and pillage and, you know, expand his kingdom to include Greece and Macedonia and all that. So he went over there and did that, and he got them all. He stirred up a hornet's nest. Okay? And it wasn't all that long after that that the Greeks became, they were extremely angry at what had happened. And this guy named Alexander the Great rose up from among them after his father, Philip of Macedon, died, I believe. And Alexander, as a very young man, set out going east. And ultimately, his goal was he was going to take down the Persian Empire. And he was going to take down everything in the way of his taking down the Persian Empire. And that's exactly what he did. And he just marched through there and just conquered everything. And that's, of course, the story in Daniel of the ram and the goat. Now, he goes on to define the events that occurred after Alexander. Let's pick it up in verse... 3. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion, and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, not according to his dominion, which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others beside these. Now, who is he talking about now? Excuse me?
Alexander
the Great, and it says his kingdom is going to be divided and not among his posterity. And that's because Alexander had no children. He had no sons to inherit his kingdom. He died suddenly at the age of 33. I guess he thought he was a young man and he was going to rule a long time, and he didn't have a will or he didn't have an heir. And so there his army was, had conquered the known world, and they didn't have a leader anymore. And so his four generals basically divided up his kingdom among them. But none of them were happy with what they got. So they all started fighting amongst each other, right, for more territory. All right, so this is what we see, beginning of verse 5. Also the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. Now, this is the king of the south. The king, you have to understand that when Alexander's empire was divided, it was divided into four. Two of those divisions we would call minor divisions because they had a relatively small territory and they were relatively weak leaders, all right? One of them had the area originally of Greece, Macedonia. Another one was most of Asia Minor, and then the Seleucid Empire, which was the largest of these divisions, was all of what we would call today Syria, the Holy Land, and pretty much everything going east, all the way through, you know, Jordan, through Iraq, through Iran, even into in parts of India. All right, it went a good long ways. It was a very vast territory. It was centered, this kingdom, the Seleucid Empire, was centered in the city of Antioch in Syria. That became its capital. And because Syria is, as you can see on the map here, Syria is directly north of Israel. And Egypt is south and south and west a little bit of Israel. And so when the Bible here in this passage, it's going to constantly talk about the king of the north and the king of the south. And in both, in all of these circumstances, it's talking about the Seleucid Empire to the north, which included that, excuse me, that vast area starting with Syria, and the Egyptian Empire to the south. And unfortunately, the nation of Israel was right in the middle of this. And because these two kingdoms constantly were battling each other for more territory and constantly attacking each other, and the border between them was constantly shifting north and south of Israel. So for a while, Israel would be under the rule of the Seleucid Empire, and then when the Egyptians would go in and kind of dominate them, then they would shift to being under the rule of the Egyptians. And this went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And the Israelites, you know, they didn't have a large army at the time. They weren't really self-sufficient. They had to basically bow to whoever had the territory at the time. And so they mostly played the whoever was in the lead, we're on their side today. You know, so and we see this going on all the time. And so the kings of the north, when they're coming through and they defeat the king of the south and the Israelites, they're all, you know, buddy-buddy with the Seleucid kings. And when it's the other way around, then they're all buddy-buddy with the Egyptians and so forth. And this is going on back and forth and back and forth. Now, this king that talks about in verse 5, the king of the south who becomes strong, this king is Ptolemy Philadelphus of Egypt. This is, at this time, this was the Egyptian king who ordered the translation of the Hebrew scriptures into Greek, what we call the Septuagint. He is the guy who built the library in Alexandria, Egypt, and for his library, he wanted a copy of the Jewish scriptures. And so he commissioned some of the priests at the temple in Jerusalem to come down to Alexandria in Egypt and to translate the Jewish Bible into Greek. So we have him to thank for that version of the Bible, which is really a very, very, very valuable piece of information for us, because it gives us the Jewish view of the Hebrew scriptures, because it was Jews who translated into Greek, and what they thought of the messianic prophecies prior to, this is 200 years about before Christ, maybe 300 years before Christ, prior to their anti-Christian bias that began to show up, you know, once they rejected Christ. Then the Jews, you know, they tried to twist those scriptures to mean something else. But the Septuagint gives us what their views were prior to his coming, and those prophecies are very, very favorable to the Christian interpretation of those Old Testament passages. All right, and so they have been very, very useful in the early Christians' debates against the Jews to show that it was the Jews themselves who held these views. All right, okay, so this guy becomes very strong, this Egyptian king. Now let's go down to verse 6. And at the end of some years, they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of her authority. And neither he nor his authority shall stand, but she shall be given up, and with those who bought her, and with him who beget her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. Now what this is talking about is, while these wars are going on between the Syrian king and the Egyptian king, that from time to time they get war weary and they decide that they want to make a peace treaty and a peace agreement. And so what happened was, the daughter of the Egyptian king decided to give to the Syrian king his daughter as a wife. And it didn't work out very well, because the king in the north was already married, and he already had children. But in order for, because they wanted this peace treaty to go through, he sent his first wife into exile, along with her child. And then he took the daughter of the Egyptian king as his wife, and they didn't get along all that well. Things didn't work out very well. His first wife, who was in exile, started scheming against him. And eventually, she got him to kick the Egyptian woman out and take her back. And no sooner had he taken her back than she had him assassinated. Okay, so you can see there's a lot of intrigue going on here in these stories. This is all part of history. You can read about it in the encyclopedias and so forth. Anyway, let's skip down to, I don't want to go through all the details of these kings because it'll just be boring you out of your mind. But what I want to do primarily is just hit a few highlights and then get down to the point where these things haven't been fulfilled yet. Okay, because that's going to be the critical point. So let's just skip down to verse 6. It talks about the king of the north there. This was Antiochus II. The third Seleucid king, he married this Egyptian woman named Berenice, the daughter of Ptolemy, and so forth. If you skip down to verses 7 through 9, it talks about when all this stuff went south after this marriage, that the queen, her father in Egypt, he died, and then her brother, Ptolemy, let's see if I can pronounce this, Euergetes, he became king of Egypt, and he was furious at Antiochus II and all the stuff that had happened up there. And so there's another war, another attack that goes on there. It's talked about in these verses. We're not going to read them all and go through all those details. When you get down to verse 15, we have another king who in the north, who is Antiochus III. He's the one who's called Antiochus the Great in history. He came through Israel, and the Israelites, because he had conquered the Egyptians and so forth, the Israelites, you know, they paid him a lot of tribute, and they just basically bowed down at his feet and told him what a wonderful, great ruler he was and all this kind of stuff. And so there was this kind of sort of friendly relationship between him and Israel. Now, if you go down to verse 20, let's skip all this. Go down to verse 20. We have, after him, we have Seleucus IV. Seleucus IV, he was a king of the north of the Seleucid Empire. And he was a fairly weak king. He didn't rule for very long. But by this time, the Roman Empire was really growing and swallowing up a lot of territory. And they were pressing into the Seleucid Empire and taking parts of it and so forth. Anyway, the Seleucid Empire was becoming weaker. The Romans were defeating them on certain fronts and so forth. Anyway, in order to kind of get a sort of a partial peace treaty with Rome, he had to pay Rome back for all the money they spent attacking him. You know, what a deal, right? So what he did was he put a heavy tax on his own people in order to raise up enough money to pay the Romans what they were demanding to basically stop their pressing forward, taking his territory. All right, and this is the one who raised taxes that the scripture talks about here in verse 20. And remember, Daniel's writing all this stuff down a long time before these events actually occurred. But he's writing these incredible details that are really very, very remarkable. Right? All right, so let's go down to verse 21. All right, now beginning in verse 21, we have the account of Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth, who was Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes means what? Manifestation, something like that. And what he had was Antiochus Theos Epiphania, Antiochus, the manifest God. All right, that was what he had on his coins. He's basically claiming to be God in flesh. This is the guy that it says, in his place, that was the one who was raising taxes, Seleucus II. He says, in his place shall arise a vile person. Now, this vile person is Antiochus Epiphanes. This is the little horn with the loud mouth in Daniel chapter 7. I'm sorry, chapter 8. Okay, the guy speaking pompous words and all that. It says, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue, and that's exactly what he did. He did some manipulating behind the scenes. He got some other foreign kings to support him, and he took the kingdom in a way that it wasn't supposed to fall to him, but he ended up getting it anyway. With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. This is talking about the high priest of Israel at the temple. He deposed the high priest at the temple that was not favorable to him, and he installed a high priest at the temple that was favorable to him and to his, let's say, more liberal interpretations of who God is, right? Because the thing about Antiochus Epiphanes was he did not, even though he was a Syrian by descent and Persian, he did not worship the gods of the Persians or the Syrians or those Semitic gods from his own ancestors. Instead, he was a big, big proponent of Hellenism, a big proponent of Greek culture, Greek philosophy, and Greek mythology. And so everywhere he went, he forced his people, because he saw that Alexander, you know, Alexander was from Greece, and of course, you know, he had part of Alexander's kingdom, and he saw that Alexander's kingdom, the cement that was holding Alexander's kingdom together, was forcing all these cultures to adopt these Greek ways, adopt the Greek gods, and so forth. So rather than promoting his own gods from his own ancestry, he promoted the Greek culture. All right, and so you know the story of the Maccabees. He went in the temple and he put an altar or an image of Zeus, the main Greek god, and so forth. And we'll see that. Actually, I'm not going to go through all the details of his wars. He fought back and forth with the king of Egypt repeatedly, again, just like his predecessors had done. But let's just skip down to verse 29. At the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south. And this is a second time that he's attacking Egypt. He attacked them previously. He's attacking them again. He shall go to the south, but it shall not be as the former or the latter. For the ships of, it says Cyprus in this version. In the King James Version, it says Kittim. But the word in the Hebrew language really refers to those of the far west. And in other places, it's referring to basically Rome. And it was the Roman Empire that was opposing him. All right, he had the Romans against him in the north, or to the west of him. He had Egypt against him to the south. He thought he was going to come down and capture Egypt, expand his kingdom down there. But all of a sudden, the king in the south, in Egypt, he calls up the guys in Rome. He says, hey, Antiochus Epiphanes is sending his armies down here to attack me. Will you help me? And Rome was no friend of Antiochus Epiphanes. And so they sent a ship or ships, Roman navy, down towards Egypt to Alexander, where he was bringing his army down the coast. And this Roman official met him and said that the Roman Senate, has voted that if you engage Egypt in war, then we are going to declare war on your kingdom. And Antiochus didn't want to give an answer, and so the Roman official drew his famous line in the sand, a circle around him, and he said, you're not leaving this circle until you give me an answer. And if you leave this circle without giving me an answer, Rome is declaring war on you. And so he put his tail between his legs, and he turned his army around, and he headed back to Syria. And you can read about it here. It talks about how he goes, it's probably my son calling again, right? How he goes back through Israel, and he's furious, and he takes out his anger on the nation of Israel. It says in verse 30. For the ships of Kittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant, that's God's people, Israel, and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy covenant. And those are the apostate Jews that were converting over to his pagan deities and agreeing to worship his pagan deities in order to keep peace and so forth. So they go in league with him, but there's a large number of Jews that refuse to do that. And so it says, and forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. They shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Now, this is where what Antiochus did is referred to as the abomination of desolation. And that's a very, very, very important point, because later in Matthew chapter 24, verse 15, 200 years later, Jesus said to his disciples when they were asking him about the end times and what should they watch for as a sign of his coming, he says, when you see the abomination of desolation that was spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, that is in the temple, that's when you're to flee to the mountains and all that. And he says there's going to be this time of trouble, of like the world has never seen. And then following that, the resurrection and the second coming of the Son of God, right? So we see the abomination of desolation here spoken of Antiochus Epiphanes. Verse 32, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And this is referring to the Maccabean revolt against Antiochus's army. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. How long did this last of Antiochus defiling the temple and persecuting the Jews? Who can tell me?
3 years
to the day on the Jewish lunar calendar, all right, to the very day. It was the 25th day of the month Kislev, which would roughly correspond to our December. All right, now it's not the 25th of December. All right, it usually falls much earlier in the month than that. It wasn't Christmas Day. Okay? So I want you guys getting the wrong idea. But that was the day that he defiled the temple, and it was on the 25th of the same month, 3 years later, that the temple had been cleansed and they were offering animal, the morning and evening sacrifices again after he was defeated. Now, how was he defeated? Well, what happened was he went off, there was an uprising out in the eastern part of his kingdom that he was a little concerned about. So he took his army to go there, and he left one of his generals and part of his army in Judea to continue to enforce his persecution of the Jews, which he thought would be easily handled by his those he left. And so he took the majority of his army, he went east, and while he was there, the Maccabees defeated his army, drove them out, and cleansed the temple, and started offering their sacrifices again. And word of that got to Antiochus, and almost immediately, when he got word that his army had been defeated, suddenly, in fact, the book of 2 Maccabees specifically says that the Lord struck him down. And he got this internal issue going on, and his bowels were coming out, and he stunk so bad he couldn't even stand himself until he just basically passed in a very gruesome way. And the book of Maccabees specifically says that the Lord God struck him down. All right? Well, if you continue reading in this chapter, it talks about the events of the Maccabees, what they did. If you go down to verse 35, it talks about those of understanding who will fall and to refine them and all that. Verse 36, then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemous things against the God of gods. And of course, you know, he's the guy who named himself God manifest. He shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God, it says the God singular in the New King James, but most English versions say the gods plural, and I'm convinced that that is the correct interpretation, because it's talking about Antiochus, and God singular of his fathers is, they had many gods, right? The Persians and the Syrians, they had many gods, but he did not regard them. As I said before, he did not regard the gods of his own nationality he instead regarded the Greek gods. Or he at least forced his subjects to worship them, although he didn't regard any gods himself, because he thought he was God. Anyway, neither shall he regard any god, for he shall exalt himself above them all. But in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses, and a god which his fathers did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory. And that was Zeus, the Greek god, the primary Greek god. And he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. And he did that as well with the land of Israel. Now, in verse 40, something odd happens. If you read biblical commentaries, and I'm talking about not just, you know, some fad commentary. I'm talking about the big commentaries written by the scholars, the historians, all that kind of stuff. If you read them, they are basically uniformly agreed that this is talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, and they talk about all the details that he did, you know, giving all the historical documentation for all these things and so forth. But when you get to verse 40, they are almost unanimously in agreement that the events in verse 40 through 44 or 45, that Antiochus did not do that. He did none of that. It talks about another invasion of Egypt. And Antiochus did not invade Egypt another time. The historical record is pretty agreed that he went, you know, he died on this other campaign and he did not invade Egypt another time. But look what it says. It says, and at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. And the king of the north shall come against him, that is the king of the south, like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. So now we've got what appears to be, with a natural reading of the text, Antiochus Epiphanes engaging the Egyptians another time that come against him, but now he's coming against them with overwhelming force, right? And what happens? It says, he shall also enter the glorious land, which is Israel, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Well, there's no record of him attacking Egypt again. All right? He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all precious things of Egypt. Also, the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. There's no record of this happening, any of this, in history. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore, he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Did Antiochus Epiphanes ever build his palace in Israel on Mount Zion? No, he never did that. He passed through there a few times. He defiled the temple. He never moved there. Right? None of this stuff has happened. And he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. Now, the problem here is that a natural reading of this account, there is no change of person here from Antiochus Epiphanes to this person that's talked about as the king of the north, just like Antiochus was talked about. There's no apparent shift in persons. The only clue we have that something has changed, it says that, starting in verse 40, that these events are going to happen in the time of the end. So there seems to be a shift in time, but there does not seem to be a shift in persons. All right, now, look what happens after that. In chapter 12, it starts out by saying, at that time. The question is, at what time? And the Greek and the Hebrew are very clear that it means at that exact time that these things are happening. That is, this second invasion of Egypt and these things that are occurring in the verses prior to it. That at that time, when he attacks Egypt and these things occur, it says, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that time. And at that time, again, the same phrase, your people shall be delivered, every one who is found written in the book, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some, or literally the rest, for shame and everlasting contempt. And those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. So we have a time of trouble followed by the resurrection of the dead, those who are asleep in their graves, coming up out of their graves. And it is at the time that a natural reading of this text says that Antiochus Epiphanes attacks Egypt, which would be actually the third time in the narrative, and actually conquers them, which he's never done. No king has ever done this. Now, the question is it the same man? A natural reading of the text indicates it's the same man. But how come he died and he didn't do it? Did the prophecy fail? How could the prophecy be true and yet he died prior to doing that? I can only think of one way. Can you?
Come forth.
I'll be back.
I'll be back. Yes, you can ask me.
Do you have any comment on the last verse of the 11th verse? Besides him planning his palace in Jerusalem and him coming to an end with no one to help him, is that at the very, very end?
I believe so.
Yeah,
I think when he commits the abomination of desolation that Jesus talked about in Matthew 24, that he indeed is going to place his palace there on Mount Zion. I mean, Satan's ultimate goal, I mean, because, you know, we're talking about demonic entities here as well, right? But working through individuals, and the Antichrist is going to be a demon-possessed man. And what is his ultimate goal? What is Satan's ultimate goal anyway? You know, what does he say?
I
will exalt my throne above the stars of God, right? That he's going to sit in the far north, he says, or something like that. He's talking about the North Star. But he says to sit on the mount of the congregation. He's talking about Israel coming, you know, and worshiping him instead of worshiping God Almighty. What does Paul say about the Antichrist in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2? It says he enters into the temple of God, right? Showing himself that he is God. He's going to demand worship as God. What does the word Antichrist mean? Who can tell me what that term means? It's a combination of two terms, a preposition and the word Christ.
Opposed to Christ.
Yes. Does it mean false Christ? No, that would be pseudo-Christ. Antichrist means against Christ. It means instead of Christ. It's an alternative to Christ. See, when Jesus in the Olivet Discourse, he said that in the last days there will be false prophets, plural. There will be false pseudo-Christs, plural. But he never once mentioned a ultimate false pseudo-Christ. The only one, the single person, is never called a false Christ in the Bible. That is one who pretends to be Christ. He is called the Antichrist, meaning the replacement for Christ, the one opposed to Christ, the one instead of Christ. It's like convincing Israel, no, you don't want that Messiah, you want this, my Messiah. See, the one you're looking for, he's not going to help you. Satan is saying, I'm going to give you another Savior that's going to save you. All right, there's a huge difference between a pseudo-Christ and a Antichrist. In fact, the Apostle Paul used that term Antichrist. The Apostle John used the term Antichrist. And he said, even now, there are many Antichrists. Right? Whereby we know that it is the last hour. He said, you have heard that the Antichrist is coming, but even now there are many Antichrists. Was he talking about many people claiming to be Jesus? No. He was talking about many people, many Gnostic teachers, who were claiming to have a different kind of Christ, a more cosmic kind of Christ than the one that's in the Bible. Right? It's a different kind of Savior that they are offering. Anyway, in chapter 12, I'm not going to go any more into chapter 12. Daniel asks a couple of questions about, you know, how this is all going to play out. Maybe we can talk about that tomorrow morning a little bit. He gives some time periods, some numbers of days, things like that. Tomorrow I want to primarily talk about the number of his name. Revelation talks about the mark of the beast and the number of his name. And the process that most Christians have been using to try to discover the name of the Antichrist, and they're using a process of assigning numerical values to letters and so forth, which is actually a pagan process. It's not a Christian or a Jewish process. It was a process that the Gnostics used in trying to determine secret meanings and all that kind of stuff. So what I'm going to show you tomorrow is, I think, and this is a fairly recent thing on my part, because I used to try to figure out the number using all that stuff too, but I came to realize that why would God use a process that was used by the pagan mystics in order to warn us about the name of the Antichrist? Why wouldn't he use something a little more straightforward, that you wouldn't have to be a mathematical genius and know ancient languages and numerical values of ancient letters in languages that we never even hardly heard of, to warn us about the Antichrist? I mean, you have to be some kind of a linguistic scholar and archaeologist in order to figure out the name of the Antichrist. Would God be that cryptic? Or would he do something that was so obvious, it's as plain as the nose on our face, and that the name of the Antichrist is actually in the Bible? Oh. Well, imagine that. So we'll look at that tomorrow morning, and a few little things about the beast and so forth in Revelation to try to maybe tie up some of these loose ends. Okay, any questions or comments? I think Jen was up first. Well, I think he will be, no, I think he will be, you know, now we're going to assume for a moment, give you the benefit of the doubt, okay, that there's enough evidence here that to say that Antiochus is coming back, okay? If that's the case, at what point would he come back, right? I think he would have to come back soon enough to gain power and prominence again in Syria, in the area of Syria, because if you read, if what I'm telling you is right about these things that he's going to do in attacking Egypt, we're going to be seeing some activity going on in between Egypt and Syria, right? And actually, if you read the news, those two countries are right in the middle of it right now, right? I mean, there's this big civil war going on in Syria. The Russians are backing the Syrian king, who's there now. And the status of that country and how it's going to turn out is very much up in the air and in question. And the United States can't seem to make up our minds if we're going to support the rebels against them, or if we're going to, you know, Obama's foreign policy is a total train wreck. You guys, I'm sure, are well aware of that. He doesn't know what he's doing. You know, he supports these guys and those guys, and they kill these guys, and it's a total train wreck. But Hillary will fix all that. Yeah, I'm sure. But but anyway, keep your eye on Syria, because he's coming out of Syria, all right? I'm telling you, the Antichrist is coming out of Syria. He's also called the Assyrian in several places in the Bible, which goes towards his lineage, all right? There's so many things, I think, that line up very well and easily when you have this understanding. But keep this in mind. It's at the time that he attacks Egypt that it says the time of trouble is going to begin. And that is around the time when he defiles the temple and at the midpoint of the tribulation. So he's going to have to be on the scene before that. However, are we going to be able to identify him necessarily? Well, Paul says in 2 Thessalonians 2 that that the coming of Christ is not going to occur until the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed. Revealed means uncovered, made known, right? And it goes on to say how that happens. He enters the temple of God, you know, takes a seat in the temple of God and claims to be God. All right, so that is really the unveiling of who he is without any question. All right, but if we know his name in advance, if we know the name he's going to be using in advance, it might be helpful, right?
Sniper Bishop.
So we'll see about that tomorrow. Yeah. All right. Somebody else have hands up. Yes. 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 Right. We'll see that the ten kings are going to be coming out of Europe. And eventually, this is going, they are going to, these two are going to coalesce together. All right. And he is going to become the leader. And that's when the who hits the fan. All right. Yeah, dude.
I was just
going
to say in verse 37, when it says, shall regard thee to the God of his fathers, or the desire of women, do you have any insight into what that might be about? Obviously, well, it doesn't care what women think, but why is there going to mention that? You
know, I don't know, but when he's on the scene, maybe we'll see. You know, that could mean several different things. It could mean he doesn't regard the things that women want. It could mean he doesn't regard that maternal, you know, thing that the women have for children. It could mean he's gay, for all I know. You know, I mean, there's so many things it could mean that... I don't know. I haven't researched that at all, so I really can't comment on it. But I do think that the previous statement about not regarding the gods of his fathers is clearly a reference to the fact that he promoted the Greek gods as opposed to his own Semitic gods. So, yeah, Chase. Well, let me ask you this. In 2 Thessalonians 2, when Paul said what he was going to do, it says he is going to enter into the temple of God, and it doesn't say saying that he is Christ. It says saying that he is God. All right, now that's something altogether different. And he's essentially going to elevate himself above the God of Israel. Now, to say you're God can mean two different things. It could mean to say that I am Jehovah God, that is the God of Israel, or it could mean I am the supreme God, right? Because the word God is a title, not really a name. So to say I am the supreme God is saying I am greater than the God of Israel, right? Not I am the God of Israel. It's a totally different thing, all right? God is a title, not a name. Anybody else? Yeah. Well, it's all right. In the previous class, we were on chapter. Well, we talked about Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the ten toes. They came out of the feet of iron and clay, which come from the legs of iron. All right, which was the Roman Empire. And in the Daniel 7, we had the fourth beast. He had the the first beast was a lion. It was Babylon. The second beast was a bear, which was Persia. Then the goat. Not was it the goat? No, the leopard. Leopard of four heads, yes, which was Alexander the Great and his kingdom that was divided. And then after that was this great and terrible beast that had ten horns. And the feature about that beast was that it broke the land in pieces and it ground the rest to powder. And in my opinion, he's talking there about the way the Romans completely and utterly obliterated Judea and Jerusalem 40 years after the crucifixion of Christ. In contrast to what Nebuchadnezzar did. Nebuchadnezzar broke down the city and he broke down the temple, but he didn't utterly destroy everything, right? He left the walls, they needed to be repaired and whatnot, and he even left a remnant in the land to tend the land. So his destruction was more, I mean, it was pretty severe, but it wasn't absolute total obliteration. The Romans, on the other hand, the fourth beast, absolutely obliterated and ground to powder Jerusalem and that whole land, to the point where Jesus prophesying said not one stone would even be left on another that would not be thrown down. Josephus says that you couldn't even tell. He was an eyewitness to the battle. He said after the Romans were finished, you couldn't even tell there had been a city there. I mean, that they absolutely took everything down. The only thing left was a Roman fort. You know? So I think that's what it's talking about, that fourth beast. Now, that's the Roman Empire. There's no question about it because they're the ones that destroyed Israel and Jerusalem in that way. Well, the ten horns come out of that fourth beast, right? So because that's the case, and if the fourth beast is the Roman Empire, then those ten kings have to come out of the old Roman Empire, which is basically Europe today, right? It extends a little bit beyond Europe, but it was Europe today. But then we have, in Daniel 7, we have the little horn coming up among the ten. And when it says that the ten come up from the fourth beast, the very next verse says the little horn comes up and he's not like the rest. Meaning, he's not coming up from the Roman Empire, right? He's coming up next to the Roman Empire, aside from them. But in Revelation, we learn that these ten kings then turn their dominion over to him and they reign along with him as a unit. Alright, so there's going to be a merger between this revival of the Roman Empire and then this outsider from Syria. Okay? Yes? I don't think so. You know, I really don't have much on the false prophet. And there's not much given to us on it. There's nothing in the Old Testament on it that I'm aware of. And all we know about him is what's said in Revelation chapter 13, basically. And I think one or two other just brief mentions of him later in Revelation. So I think he is, you know, I think when you look at the Antichrist, in my view, the Antichrist does not pretend to be Christ. He is instead of Christ. He presents himself as the alternative to Christ. And I think the false prophet is the counterpart or alternative to Elijah the prophet who precedes, you know, the coming of the true Christ. And so, you know what, Satan's kind of a crafty guy, but he doesn't have an original thought in his head. See, all he does is copy what God does, because God's pretty impressive. So he tries to corrupt it and copy it and say, you know, hey, I can do it better than him. It's like the you know, Moses and Aaron when they went before Pharaoh. You know, Moses throws his staff on the ground and becomes a snake. Well, what do the Egyptians do? Do something else that's bigger and greater? No, they try to copy what Moses does, but then Moses, you know, staff eats up there. So God ultimately shows him it's right. Well, this seems to be Satan's pattern. He kind of copies what God does, but he completely perverts it. And then he tries to show that he's greater than God. Now, God sent his son. His son was raised from the dead. That's pretty impressive. Well, then what's Satan going to try to do? Top that. Top that. And then God sends his two witnesses. Elijah, obviously, since it's Elijah in the last days, he has to be raised from the dead, right? And if the other is John, which I believe it is. And then what does he do? He comes back from the dead, and he kills the other two guys that God raised from the dead. I mean, he's the greatest now, right? So, I mean, it's like, let me top this to show that I am more powerful than God. And if he can persuade people that he is more powerful than the God of Israel, then he's going to get the world to follow him. He doesn't want to pretend to be the God of Israel and say, look, I'm the God of Israel. He's got, you know, the God of Israel mask on and get everybody to bow down to him because they're not worshiping him. They're still worshiping the God of Israel. They just think they just got the wrong guy. That's not what he's after. He's after people to worship him for who he is. And he wants to say, I am greater than God, and you can live in your sin and your depravity and worship me, and you can still have eternal life. Because I'm going to defeat that God. Which is why, you know, it says at the end of the tribulation, the beast, the Antichrist, and all the kings of the earth gathered together at the battle for the battle of Armageddon. And it specifically says that they gather there to oppose Christ at his coming. That is the purpose for their gathering there. They actually believe that they can overthrow the second coming of Jesus Christ. It's a suicide mission, I promise you. But they actually think they can do that. And that's because Satan has convinced them to worship him instead of God. All right? So, anyway. It's the lie. Anybody else? Mike?
I didn't really have questions or comments earlier when we were talking about chapter 11, verse 20, about the greatest conversion being able to understand if it's Christ.
Or the angel for 21 days, yeah.
The word withstand doesn't necessarily have to be in a physical location, right?
Not necessarily.
So it doesn't mean that if it is Christ, he was incapable or does not have the authority to overthrow it.
It can be an authority thing. Yeah.
Much more different than, I'm withstanding you now if you're going forward with what you want.
Yeah.
Yeah. Authority or
yeah, and not only that, see, Satan is given certain amounts of authority by God. He's a but like I said, he's on a leash. All right, he's given authority, he's given limits and parameters. And Michael and his angels are there to enforce the limits and the parameters that God has put on him. So it doesn't necessarily mean he's greater in any way, but in that particular situation, you know, that's how it's playing out. So anyway, I mean, look. A lot of this, you know, when we talk about the demonic activity going on behind the scenes, we have to speculate a little bit because there's really not very much information given to us, and a lot of the why questions aren't really answered. But with what we do know, with the limited amount we know, anyway, that's what we've got to work. Anybody else, and I'll close it down.